Rebecca, how are you?
I'm fine. It's nice to meet you, Emily.
I know, it's nice to meet you too, although it's virtually speaking. I'm Emily Bazelon. I'm a senior editor at Slate. I'm here with Rebecca Traister, who is an excellent Salon writer. Do you want to further introduce yourself?
Yeah, I am a senior writer at Salon, and I write a lot about women and politics and media.
Excellent. So we thought we'd talk about a few different aspects of the recession today, and particularly the recession and its effect on relationships and gender. We were going to start by talking about the media coverage of the recession and how kind of some tropes to do with dating and women and gender are playing out. Rebecca, I know you've been working on a piece about this, so tell me what your kind of thoughts and argument are at the moment.
Well, there was this piece that actually ran at the end of January in the New York Times that got a lot of attention, and it was about a group called DABA, which was short for Dating a Banker Anonymous. And it was a piece that got a lot of finger-wagging attention and sort of, you know, fist-shaking attention, because it chronicled the purported meetings and website of this purported support group for young women in New York City who were dating bankers who used to wine and dine them and take them around the world and treat them really well, and now their bankers were depressed and they needed to be nurtured, and in some cases they were having sexual side effects, and this, it was this absolutely hateful story reliant on, you know, some of the most repugnant stereotypes of both femininity and masculinity available to the cultural imagination. It got a lot of attention, and at the time it even read like gender pantomime.
That's a great phrase.
I mean, it was clearly some kind of performance, and that's not to say that it was automatically untrue, though, oddly enough, last week the New York Times ran an editor's note claiming, somewhat confusingly, that in fact the women in the story were this was a satirical website, we weren't to quite take it seriously. So it's still very muddy about how real the story was. But clearly there was some kind of performance of characters. Characters we were obviously yearning for. That piece got sent all around the blogosphere. It got commented on. Everybody I knew called me about it. My boyfriend's mother called me about it saying, "Do you know people like this?" You know, it really sort of was some of the most hateful versions of femininity, and everybody was very excited about it. So it turns out that it may or may not have been authentic. But last week, the Washington Post ran a story that was like its cousin about the perils of dating for young people in Washington, D.C. And this involved going to a club where there were lots of young men saying, "Oh, I can't woo women anymore because I can't take them to the expensive meals." And women saying, "Oh, I don't want to date somebody who can't take care of me in the style to which I've become accustomed." It, too, had that feel of sort of junky romantic comedy. And I'm very curious. That got a lot of attention, too, at least from, you know, people who were sending it to me and saying, "What do you make of this?" And I'm very curious about the impulse to cover courtship rituals in a recession through this lens. Oh, I'm sorry, there seems to be a fire outside the house.
Yikes!
I think it says something interesting about our desire to read about these caricatures of masculinity and femininity that may in fact exist in a teeny, teeny, tiny privileged population of Americans and may have persisted in recent years, but really are these kind of old, musty stereotypes of not only young man as breadwinner, but young man as somebody who needs to unfurl all of his you know, $400 meal peacock feathers, trips on private jet peacock feathers. This is really, I don't think many of us know people who mate this way anymore. And I find it very interesting that in this time of financial anxiety and also gender anxiety, which we're going to talk a little bit about, the recession is creating some serious shifts in how we think about men, women, and work, and power, and money, that we're returning to these sort of comfortably hateful cartoons of young men and women.
So, okay, so it seems like the reason that you're finding this DABA story, I love that the acronym for Dating Banker Anonymous is DABA, the hateful aspect of it is that you have these kind of chicks who are, like, on the make. They just want to, you know, go out with the guys who can spring for the really expensive meals. And it's not about the relationship. It's not about any kind of real human warmth or contact. It's, like, about conquest. And then you have these men who are kind of equally caricatured as these, like, very straight-laced bankers who are just, like, cruising for women and using money as a way to attract women, right? So that's, like, the main objection. But are you feeling like that? Okay, so then there's this problem with the story. Part of the story turns out it seems to be made up. In fact, there was a website called Dating a Banker Anonymous, but it wasn't functioning as a real support group. And so that was why the Times, I think, had to run that editor's note and back away from their original story.
There are questions about that remain unanswered about whether or not there were people who then authentically contributed to that website. I mean, there
right,
it's very
totally.
Confusing.
Yeah, there could have been people who saw the website and found like that this was a real premise that spoke to them. But so my question to you is, are you objecting to the Times for having covered this Dating a Banker Anonymous, or having been so credulous and not like tried to poke at it and make sure this was a real thing, or to really understand what it was before they ran the story?
Well, I think I'm not so much, I'm not suggesting that the Times shouldn't have run the story. I think the thing that I'm interrogating is our appetite for the story.
Uh-huh.
And also, if there is a criticism of the Times, and I should say that as a reporter, if I came across a story like that, the Dating a Banker Anonymous story, and I guess there are lots of questions about whether or not somebody should have, I don't know anything about the reporting process in it, I don't know how the women presented themselves. I don't know how duped the Times was. I don't know how serious or unserious they were. It's very unclear how much of it was satire. But if I were to come across that story and check it out and it seemed real, of course, it's a story. It's a story that grabs you. I would not ever criticize somebody for covering something like that. I think that my criticism, which is itself a murkier one, is with the enthusiasm. Actually, and there is a complaint with the Times, the sort of enthusiastic credulity, that there weren't a series of questions asked about these women. Many of them, according to the Times, were in high-paying professions. There were sort of very few questions asked about how were they paying for their own. Okay, if these men were no longer providing for them in the way that they needed, why, you know, how were they paying for their own expensive cocktails and you know, the fancy places they were going for their support group meetings? There was, you know, why did they marry? There was one newlywed in the story who talked about how this was not what I signed up for because her wealth manager husband was depressed and she needed to take care of him. And she said, that's not what I signed up for. And she'd been married 3 months before. And there wasn't a sort of, well, what did you think you signed up for? Are you objecting to the idea of being an emotional helpmate to your spouse? It did sort of revel in some of the more hateful, shallow, caricatured details of these women without sort of interrogating the story and saying, really, how common is this? And really, is this what you sign up for in a relationship? It didn't press them on that. But I'm also very interested in how eagerly we all lapped it up, me included. You know, I wanted to shake a hateful fist at it as much as the next person. And then with the Washington Post story about dating, I'm just curious about whether or not we have an impulse to represent these stories, which are undoubtedly eye-catching, as somehow emblematic of how young people are meeting and mating in hard economic times, when in fact I don't really believe they're emblematic at all.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'm sure they're not emblematic. I'm not sure I think that the stories get lapped up because people think they're typical. I think there's some larger phenomenon going on of, like, the poor little rich kid recession story. Like, the Times has done stories about, you know, the teenager who has to give up her twice weekly private Pilates lesson. Like, these things that are just so clearly not real deprivations, they almost seem like caricatures in themselves. And I'm not sure. I think that the coverage is sort of fumbling right now. There are lots of, you know, how we live now stories about the recession. And some of them are very vivid and real. I mean, there was a piece in the Times last weekend about a man who had been making, I think, $70,000 a year, lost his job, was working as a janitor for $10 an hour, and it was about his kind of struggle to maintain his dignity. Now, like, that's about a totally different class. It's about a man. It was just written in a much more respectful way. And then there are all these, like, frivolous stories. And to me, they feel almost nostalgic. Like, they're what we wish the recession was really about. Because if the recession is just about, like, some, you know, 25-year-old weeping over the loss of her $400 dinners, then we don't really have to worry about it. Whereas these stories about, you know, middle work class and working class people really, like, losing something important, that's much more troubling.
I think that you get at a really interesting point. It's interesting that you use the word nostalgic, because that's one of the words, as I've been writing a story about these pieces, I've also called them nostalgic. Nostalgic for a model. And I agree that the top layer of pleasure that people take in them right now is this kind of debasement of the rich and the spanking of the overprivileged, which is one of the reasons I think people love them. And I just think it's too bad that some of the gender caricatures, that really outmoded gender caricatures, seem to have been attached in the DNA of those spank the rich stories.
Yeah, that's such a good
and
point.
It was the gender characterizations that I said were sort of nostalgic gender characterizations, because part of how I have seen and sometimes reported on young people and how they deal with each other in terms of money, often in some of the same climes, urban professional climes, as these stories are taking place in, are actually much more nuanced and reflect a lot of things that have already changed before the recession about how men and women make money and relate to each other economically. And I think there are many more nuanced stories to tell about young people and how they make money and the assumptions about who makes more money and who doesn't make more money that aren't, and none of those changes that have been incremental and long coming but now seem to be about to explode in certain horrible, tragic ways, none of those shifts in how people think of money and gender are reflected in these sort of old-style man as bear-killing breadwinner, girl as lissom, money-grubbing, you know, passive attendant story. So I think that's my complaint. But maybe we should also talk about something that you've written about and I hope are going to write about again, which is the shifts that we're seeing in terms of the economy, gender, job loss, men and women, and how all of that is affecting families.
Yeah, that is something I've been thinking a lot about and working on. And it seems to me like there's this, you know, premise and possibility that we could see these positive gender shifts come out of the recession. I'm skeptical, but the notion is that, well, the silver lining in the fact that most of the people who have lost their jobs are men, the figure is 82%, is that there are going to be more women who are breadwinners, more women whose kind of second jobs in the family are now going to become first jobs, and that could shake up these more entrenched stereotypes about who earns the more money and who does what at home. So I did a piece last week or the week before in which I sent a note out to readers asking for people's stories about how layoffs had affected their relationships. And I got back a range of answers. I really enjoy getting emails like this from readers because you get you realize that people's stories never fit the kind of paradigm shift that journalists and social science pretends is out there. And it was really a range. There were men who wrote in and said that their wives had been laid off and were really desperate about it and, you know, felt terrible about themselves just the way we kind of would expect a man who had been laid off to be, the same kind of intertwining of work and identity. And then there were women who wrote in and said that, you know, their husbands were also devastated and it was really hard to know what to do next and how to handle household responsibilities. So I wonder what your thoughts about that, what your expectations would be about how these layoffs might affect traditional roles.
Well, I thought your piece on this was great in part because it was so nuanced and accounted both for sort of, I think what Lisa Belkin originally called the silver lining optimism about social change that could come out of these terrible economic conditions, but also sort of taking into account actual people's stories, because we can make all these predictions and cite all these historical models, but you know, it's really not without, you have to go out and talk to people who are living through the things that we're prognosticating about to sort of get how complicated all these situations are. I guess one of the things that I found most compelling about your piece was your worry that I think you said that it has backlash, that any kind of optimism about an evening of the gender grounds, economically or professionally, it attached to such bad economic conditions makes you nervous because it has backlash written all over it. I thought that was a really compelling point. And there are people who have pointed out that previous national crises, including World War II, which sent Rosie the Riveters into workplaces, and the recession in the 70s, which in part helped to incubate second wave feminism, did result in social change and changes within gender parity, but then were met with tremendous backlash. You know, the 1950s saw all the Rosie the Riveters sent back into their homes and attached surgically to vacuum cleaners. And the 80s saw huge backlash to second wave feminism. So I think that there is a lot to wonder about in terms of what's going to happen. I'm really curious. The examples of the women who'd been laid off and were having some of the same experiences that we naturally expect men to have, I found particularly compelling, that they were feeling useless, like hangers-on. I mean, do you think that that is a new kind of phenomenon born of now decades of women having been in the workplace and more of them being the breadwinners?
You know, I mean, I think that I don't think it's new. I think there are certainly women of previous generations who had that same deep attachment to work. But I think that it is maybe a storyline that is easier to talk about, and that that women feel more entitled to have those feelings and to express them. Although, you know, you could argue on the other hand that second wave feminism in the 70s was so celebratory of work, that in fact we've sort of lost some ground since then. So I always feel nervous about, you know, what exactly is new here. But I was struck, as you were, by how deep and vivid the feelings were that people were having, and to me it wasn't surprising at all. You know, I think there's been a lot of concern about the fragile male ego as men are forced to stay home, but I think that for anyone, really, like any person who cares about work and defines themselves in part because of their job, and of course, like, also relies on the income that comes in, that losing your job can be really devastating.
You cite the time use study in your piece that unfortunately suggests that men who've lost their jobs will do less domestic labor than we think, and perhaps
right.
less domestic labor than they did when they had jobs, whereas women who have lost their jobs will double their time spent doing domestic work, childcare, house cleaning. And that's something that you express real nervousness about, understandably. I think that I have, and are you expressing nervousness about that in part because of the emails you've been getting from people?
Well, I've been struck. I sort of put out another call for people to send me stories about exactly what you were just putting your finger on. And again, it's a real range. You know, I've heard from women who are bitterly complaining that their husbands are lying around and playing video games all day, kind of exactly mm-hmm. the stereotype of the idle male that we might have, our own caricature, since we all have caricatures in our heads sometimes. But then I've also heard from men and from women who are saying that as a result of layoffs, there's been a really practical desire to address household work. And these are kind of preliminary. They're from people who have just been laid off, who are kind of planning to redivide up household responsibilities and who are going at it with intentions of a more egalitarian approach. And so what I'll be really interested in is to follow up with these couples in 3 months or 6 months and to see how this plan is going.
Right. I'm totally fascinated by this because I am very naively, idealistically, probably slightly stupidly optimistic about a changed tenor in how men and women conceive of the household and the domestic sphere. And I think, again, I admit that I think this is really in some ways, uninformed optimism, but I cannot help but think that attitudes really are different about how men connect to their children, whether or not they're doing the work, and it seems statistically that they may not be. I think even our larger cultural attitudes about fatherhood, what it means to raise a child, are so dramatically different than they were from even a couple of generations ago. And that's something that's hard to measure, and I do worry that whenever we do measure it, we come up with a result that tells us that nothing has changed. But living in this country, you know, having been raised, having now watching my contemporaries raise children, again, it depends on what segment of the population you are in. But I do think that so many attitudes have shifted, slowly, incrementally, imperfectly, in a stop and start way, but still there has been shift in how we conceive of male and female responsibilities and attachments at home, that perhaps in 3 months we may be hearing news maybe that contradicts what we fear based on the time use study right now.
Great. Well, we'll find out. I mean, I think it's great that you're naively and even stupidly optimistic. You have to be. It's one of those things, like, you have to maintain your sense of shock or your sense of entitlement in these situations. I do think, though, it's important to separate out two strands of what you were just talking about. There's childcare and fatherhood, and then there's, mm-hmm. you know, who does the dishes and goes to the supermarket and pays the bills and rakes the lawn. Those are two different things. And I think you're right. And there is data to show that men are spending a little more time with their children. And I think certainly there are circles of men who have totally embraced that. And it's hugely important. But that doesn't mean that they're really eager to do all the other work that goes into running a household. And you know, I think we all kind of wish that work away. But someone has to do it.
Right. That's absolutely true. And then the stupid optimist in me says, well, it's something that there might be, because there was a time when men had no interest in any of the child rearing either. So I think I'm not stupidly optimistic about actual parity when it comes to domestic work. I'm optimistic about progress when it comes to conceptions of investment in a household. And I have, this is purely, purely anecdotal, but amongst the stay-at-home fathers that I know, and I know several of them, I have watched them go from absolutely no investment in the household chores to suddenly doing them because they're living in the house all day and don't like it to be dirty. You know, I've seen things, in a purely anecdotal sense, I've seen those kinds of shifts take place with time and immersion. And so maybe that accounts for some of my stupid optimism.
Right, and it'll be interesting to see whether those anecdotes about the stay-at-home dads you know, who presumably are choosing, or at least partly choosing what they're doing, if that, you know, yes. proves to apply also to this broader pool of men who are not going to be staying home as a matter of choice. So that'll be really interesting. So before we close, though, we have to talk about something that is not such a great sign of progress, which is this amazing graphic that the New York Times published this week about the pay gap, where they separated out all kinds of different professions and showed you how great the pay gap was. You know, whether it was the highest one, I think, was 40% pay gap for between men and women who are doctors and surgeons.
Surgeons, yeah.
Right. But there were all kinds of jobs represented, and there were a couple of professions I thought that were surprising, almost parity, and it was just really interesting. I had no theory for what explains, you know, why a tax collector who was a woman would make so much less than a man doing a similar job, but someone in the healthcare field or a special education teacher, it would be reversed. Did you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that there are a bunch of factors that you know, were written about in the story that accompanied the graphic. One is the question of just discrimination. I mean, just the plain old
garden
women
variety.
Getting paid less for doing the same job that has been with us for as long as women and men have been working in the same fields. So there's that, which I think is that thing you can't quite put your finger on sometimes. And you're like, well, it doesn't make sense. Right, because it's discrimination. Then there's the issue of what are often called, you know, women's choices, which is sort of euphemistic code for when women choose to leave the workforce to have kids and either stay home with them or simply ratchet back their work especially in some of the more high-powered fields. That's one of the other big factors that is always part of the explanation for why women make less, because then the thinking goes they have less, they log fewer hours, they have less experience because they take time, often in the middle, smack in the middle or beginning of their high-powered careers. And so, or that they choose not to pursue the highest posts because in whatever their given careers are, because those highest posts take too much from their lives and they don't want to give so much of their lives to their work, whereas we're told men do. So those are some of the factors that go into explaining it. I found the whole thing, I just scratched my head about so much of it, because like you, I was very much surprised by some of the professions in which pay was closer to being fair, and by some of the professions where it was just so staggeringly disparate.
Right.
I don't know that there's a clean explanation for it.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, the market and supply and demand must have something to do with some of them. But I think you're right. It was like watching this kind of kaleidoscope of employment in the country and wondering, you know, wanting to take apart all the different aspects of it. Although the general explanations that you gave, I think, are compelling, too.
I'll tell you one of the interesting things, and I should check this better. I actually read this. Megan on Jezebel pointed something out, and I followed her links, and I was totally fascinated. She was critiquing the New York Times analysis of the statistics and saying, you know, sort of, it's not about choice. It's not about, you know, staying home. It's about discrimination. That was her argument. But she cited something in particular, talking about the various fields within medicine that were studied for that story, and talking about how more men want to be surgeons so they get higher. I mean, there was this sense that a male-dominated field was going to find men paid much more than women. And she said, well, try to tell me that again when you look at the statistics for registered nurses. And I followed through her links, and sure enough, here were statistics about what registered nurses were paid broken down by gender.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a hugely female-dominated field. And yet, the median weekly wage for the smaller, much smaller percentage of men who are registered nurses was higher than for women.
Right. So at least in that field, that seems like a pretty pretty important piece of evidence that Megan had a point to make.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. I mean, I was just sort of following her through. I didn't agree with everything she said in her critique of the Times piece, but I thought that was a really fascinating catch, and something, it does make you think we need to take these things apart a lot more, because we do scratch our heads about them and there's no clean explanation, and we need to sort of think, okay, what what happens here? What is that sort of unnameable, indefinable factor that creates these gaps?
Right. And I think also there isn't necessarily a clean division between old-fashioned discrimination and these swirling, you know, muddier questions about choice that you were raising, because sometimes employers can think like, oh, I have this man in front of me. He clearly is the primary breadwinner from the family. And so they can, you know, even unconsciously adjust a pay scale in their minds based on that.
Right. And it's also true that even questions about choice, as somebody like Linda Hirschman would say very quickly, they themselves are muddy, and some of the things we're just talking about in terms of the division of domestic labor, yes, of course, it's women who have the babies and, you know, for physical and medical reasons, have to take some time from their careers, but it's also a question of what does it mean if we live in a world in which the majority of the domestic labor still falls on the shoulders of the woman. If that domestic labor were split more evenly, would the period of years in which men and women have children always get more lost for women career-wise than for men?
Right. Well, it's a really deep question about the kind of collective choice versus the individual mm-hmm. choice, and you can feel totally fine about the individual choice and then wonder about
yes.
how it's all adding up, right?
Exactly. That's not to say that there's anything funny about women choosing to stay home with their kids, but it's to say when, you know, when it always falls to the woman to make the kind of time or domestic career sacrifices in order to raise children, then exactly, you're looking at a series of collective choices and wondering what it says about how we divide and conceive of domestic, domestic labor versus public professional labor.
Yeah, totally. It's been such a pleasure talking with you this morning. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Yeah, me too. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, good. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.